The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. First of all, an article published on the 10th of November in the Religion News Service entitled, "Does Education Cure People of Faith? The Data Says No," by Ryan Burge. It's been nearly 30 years since the Washington Post published an article on Christian televangelists, describing their followers as largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. The pushback was immediate and overwhelming as thousands flooded the Post telephone switchboard and letters poured into its editors after Pat Robertson, a Yale Law School alum himself, read the offending passage on his television show, The 700 Club. It was a watershed in journalism that woke many mainstream outlets to the reality of evangelicals' demographics and power. Yet the bias that says that churches, mosques, and synagogues are filled with people who have a low level of education persists. The common assumption is that a formal education, particularly a college degree, is antithetical to religious belonging. Even a cursory look at recent data reveals that just the opposite is true. Those who are the most likely to be religiously unaffiliated are those with the lowest levels of formal education. The group that is the most likely to align with a faith tradition, those who have earned a college degree or more. The Cooperative Election Study, one of the largest publicly available surveys in the United States, began in 2008. In all 14 years since, those Americans who attained no more than a high school diploma have been more likely to report no religious affiliation than college graduates. In 2020, 38% of those who did not finish high school described their religion as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. For those who have completed some graduate school, just 32% said that they were among those unaffiliated with any religious community, a group known as the nuns. The same finding holds true in larger and more granular data sets. The NationScope survey has a total sample of more than 475,000 respondents and contains large numbers of individuals at every level of education, including nearly 9,000 respondents with a doctoral degree. Being a nun correlates most closely, at 32%, with those who have not completed high school. About a quarter of people with a high school diploma or 4 years of college are nuns, the unaffiliated, and among those with master's degrees, only a fifth say that they have no religious affiliation. When the distribution of religious traditions is visualized by educational level, this relationship between these two factors becomes clearer. The share of respondents who identify as Christians, Protestants, Catholics, and those who are just Christians, continues to rise from 61% for those with the lowest levels of education to 69% of those who have taken some graduate courses. It's also noteworthy that the share of atheists and agnostics does not rise with educational levels either. It's 8% of those with a high school diploma and 9% of those with a master's degree. The relationship between educational attainment and religiosity takes a turn, however, when people are asked about the nature of their beliefs. Religion is not just a matter of identifying with a religious tradition, after all. It often includes an actual psychological belief in a higher power. The General Social Survey asks individuals what they believe about God, offering a range of options from, "I don't believe in God," to, "I know God really exists and I have no doubts about it." Among people with no more than a high school degree, 56% indicated they were certain about their belief in God, while 7% said they didn't believe in God at all. Those who hold graduate degrees were certain about their belief in God at a much lower rate of 38%. The share who didn't believe in God at all was 10%. Certainty about the existence of a higher power seems to wobble a little then with higher educational attainment, despite an increased likelihood of being connected to a religious tradition. That finding was replicated in a recent study published in the American Sociological Review that concluded that education does seem to move individuals away from moral absolutism to moral relativism. This effect is stronger among those who major in the humanities, the arts, the social sciences, or related fields. This evidence seems to say that educated Americans are drawn to the communal aspects that religion provides, but may be more ready to question what's coming from the pulpit. It is not a surprising result, perhaps, given that higher education encourages discussion and debate, and perhaps, too, the urge to belong. Now an article from the Associated Press that was published on the 4th of November, entitled "Christian Monastery, Possibly Predating Islam, Found in United Arab Emirates," by John Gambrell. Sinia Island, United Arab Emirates. An ancient Christian monastery, possibly dating as far back as the years before Islam, spread across the Arabian Peninsula, has been discovered on an island off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, officials announced. The monastery on Sinia Island, part of the sand dune sheikdom of el-Quwain, sheds new light on the history of early Christianity along the shores of the Persian Gulf. It marks the second such monastery found in the Emirates, dating back as many as 1,400 years, long before its desert expanses gave birth to a thriving oil industry that led to a unified nation home to the high-rise towers of Abu Dhabi and Dubai. The two monasteries became lost to history in the sands of time, as scholars believe Christians slowly converted to Islam as that faith grew more prevalent in the region. Today, Christians remain a minority across the wider Middle East, though Pope Francis arrived in nearby Bahrain to promote interfaith dialogue with Muslim leaders. For Timothy Power, an associate professor of archaeology at the United Arab Emirates University, who helped investigate the newly discovered monastery, the UAE today is a melting pot of nations. The fact that something similar was happening here 1,000 years ago is really remarkable, and this is a story that deserves to be told, he said. The monastery sits on the Sinia Island, which shields the Qurabaide marshlands in el-Quwain, an emirate some 50 kilometers northeast of Dubai, along the coast of the Persian Gulf. The island, whose name means flashing lights, likely due to the effect of the white hut sun overhead, has a series of sandbars coming off of it like crooked fingers. On one, to the island's northeast, archaeologists discovered the monastery. Carbon dating of samples found in the monastery's foundation date between 534 and 656. Islam's prophet Muhammad was born around 570 and died in 632 after conquering Mecca in present-day Saudi Arabia. Viewed from above, the monastery on Sinia's island floor plan suggests early Christian worshippers prayed within a single aisle church at the monastery. Rooms within appear to hold a baptismal font, as well as an oven for baking breads or wafers for communion rites. A nave also likely held an altar and an installation for communion wine. Next to the monastery sits a second building with four rooms, likely around a courtyard, possibly the home of an abbot or even a bishop in the early church. The site saw a visit from Nur bin Mohammed Al-Kabi, the country's culture and youth minister, as well as Sheikh Majid bin Saad al-Mulla, the chairman of the al-Quwain's Tourism and Archaeology Department and a son of the Emirates ruler. The island remains part of the ruling family's holdings, protecting the land for years to allow the historical sites to be found, as much of the UAE has rapidly developed. The UAE's culture ministry has sponsored the dig in part, which continues at the site. Just hundreds of meters away from the church sits a collection of buildings that archaeologists believe belongs to a pre-Islamic village. Elsewhere on the island, piles of tossed-aside clams from pearl hunting make for massive industrialized-sized hills. Nearby also sits a village that the British blew up in 1820 before the region became part of what was known as the Trucial States, the precursor of the UAE. That village's destructions brought about the creation of the modern-day settlement of al-Quwain on the mainland. Historians say early churches and monasteries spread along the Persian Gulf to the coast of present-day Oman and all the way to India. Archaeologists have found other similar churches and monasteries in Bahrain, Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In the early 1990s, archaeologists discovered the first Christian monastery in the UAE on Sirbani Yas Island, today a nature preserve and site of luxury hotels off the coast of Abu Dhabi, near the Saudi border. It similarly dates back to the same period as the new find. However, evidence of early life along the Coral Baida marshlands in al-Quwain dates as far back as the Neolithic period, suggesting continuous human inhabitants in the area for at least 10,000 years, Powers said. Today, the area near the marshland is more known for the low-cost liquor store at the Emirates Barracuda Beach Resort. In recent months, authorities have demolished a hulking Soviet-era cargo plane linked to a Russian gunrunner known as the Merchant of Death, as it builds a bridge to the Sinai Island for a $675 million real estate development. Powers said that development spurred the archaeological work that discovered the monastery. That site and others will be fenced off and protected, he said, though it remains unclear what other secrets of the past remain hidden just under a thin layer of sand. It's a really fascinating discovery because in some ways, it's hidden history. It's not something that's widely known, Powers said. Now an article published on the 3rd of November by the Religion News Service entitled, New Hulu Documentary Recaps Rise of Moral Majority and Downfall of Jerry Falwell Jr. by Emily McFarlane Miller. Look, if I would have known that accepting this woman's invitation to go back to her hotel room would have led to a scandal involving the president of the largest Christian university in the world and the President of the United States, I would have walked away and just enjoyed my private life. And so begins the new documentary, God Forbid. The confession by Giancarlo Granda is in reference to his claims of a years-long sexual relationship with Becky Falwell under the blessing of her husband, the then-president of Liberty University, Jerry Falwell Jr. The film, sharing Granda's story, which clocks in at nearly 2 hours, was released in early November and is streaming on platform Hulu. Despite its subtitle, The Sex Scandal That Brought Down a Dynasty, and sometimes lurid descriptions of Granda's alleged relationships with the Falwells, the documentary by director Billy Corbin isn't just about the sex scandal that led to Falwell Jr.'s resignation as president and chancellor of Liberty University in 2020. It is also about Jerry Falwell Jr.'s success in accomplishing the aims of the moral majority, founded by his father, the late Reverend Jerry Falwell Sr., with Falwell Jr.'s endorsement of Donald Trump's presidential run in 2016. In a very real way, Jerry Falwell Jr. has now officially completed the work that his father began, New York Times opinion writer Megan K. Stack says, as the film draws to a close. She describes the now disgraced son as the black sheep of the Falwell family and a rejected member of the evangelical community. But, she says, Falwell Jr. is the one who actually has delivered to them in a very real way the one thing that they most sought. In the documentary, Granda says Becky Falwell invited him to her hotel room in March 2012 when he was a 20-year-old pool attendant at the Fontainebleau Miami Beach Hotel, where the two engaged in oral sex while her husband watched. It was the beginning of a 7-year relationship that included vacationing with the couple and even attending their children's weddings, according to Granda's account. The Falwells and Granda later became business partners, with the couple offering Granda a share in a Miami youth hostel. Falwell Jr. has said publicly that his wife had an affair with an unnamed family friend, but maintained that he was not involved. Granda didn't realize who the couple was, he says, until Falwell Jr. emailed him photos from their trip to Miami, and his sister recognized the evangelical leader's name. Granda had never even heard of Liberty University, at one time the world's largest Christian university. He'd eventually visit Liberty in September 2012 to hear Trump speak at Convocation, which Liberty calls the world's largest gathering of Christian students. Trump appears again in the film when his fixer, Michael Cohen, allegedly intervenes to stop the release of personal photos involving the Falwells and Falwell Jr., becomes one of the first and most vocal evangelical leaders to endorse Trump's ultimately successful run for president in 2016. Through historians of American religion such as Anthea Butler and Randall Balmer, God Forbid draws parallels between Jerry Falwell Jr.'s support for Trump and his father's support for former President Ronald Reagan. The film points to evangelicals' outsized influence in the 2016 election, Trump's Supreme Court nominees overturning abortion rights, the crumbling wall between church and state, and the rise in Christian nationalist ideology, all as a culmination of Falwell Sr.'s work in building the moral majority. Meantime, Granda says in the film, things started slowly morphing from this is just sex and friendship to now we're going to control you. A job offer was rescinded. The Falwells settled a lawsuit over the Miami hostel, and Granda says he watched as Trump, who had come to power in part because of Falwell Jr.'s endorsement, magnified divisions in the country over the pandemic and racial violence. When I hit rock bottom, I had two choices, take my own life or take back control, Granda says. As he watched not only his own life but the country spiral, Granda says he decided to make his story public, thinking he could keep Falwell Jr. from having the same impact in the 2020 election as he had in 2016. Falwell Jr. took an indefinite leave of absence from Liberty University in 2020 after outcry over questionable photos he posted on social media, then resigned after Granda's story appeared in an article by investigative reporter Aram Rostin for Reuters. Falwell since has been sued by the school and tweeted that he'd been banned from its campus. Granda recently published a book written with Mark Ebner, who also was featured in the documentary entitled Off the Deep End, Jerry Falwell and Becky Falwell and the Collapse of an Evangelical Dynasty. Last of all, we have an article from the Religion News Service published on the 4th of November entitled In Raising Lazarus, Beth Macy Summons the Stone Rollers by Elizabeth E. Evans. In the gospel parable of the resurrection of Jesus' friend Lazarus, Jesus is in charge of the miracle. But it's the community around the dead man that does the work of rolling away the stone and pulling off the burial shroud. We all have a role to play in the miracle, but none of us is the miracle worker, says the Reverend Michelle Mathis in a sermon recounted in journalist Beth Macy's new book, Raising Lazarus. Mathis' interpretation of the Lazarus story captures the philosophy behind an approach to addiction and recovery called harm reduction. Rather than stigmatizing drug users or assuming that all of them can be cured simply by practicing abstinence from illicit substances, harm reduction prioritizes their mental, social, and physical health while making treatment more accessible. Harm reduction did not originate in Christian circles. The concept behind it first appeared in the 1960s and 70s, with some traced back to activist aid programs begun by Black Panthers, and gained wider currency during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. Harm reduction is the basis of needle exchange programs and the push to get naloxone into the hands of those most likely to save lives. Its guiding principle in the formulation of Chicago Recovery Alliance co-founder John Sisler is any positive change. But many in the faith community have adopted harm reduction as not only sensible, but the most compassionate way to treat the addicted. Mathis, a leader in a national group called Faith and Harm Reduction, co-founded Olive Branch Ministry in Hickory, North Carolina, in a trailer outside the town's Northminster Presbyterian Church with her wife, Karen Lowe. They describe it as America's only queer and biracial harm reduction ministry. "Once I got involved in what harm reduction was," said Mathis, who was ordained in a non-denominational church, "it was not an enabling kind of thing. It was urgent and necessary, and we're being immoral if we don't." Raising Lazarus, which follows Macy's 2018 best-selling book, Dope Sick, consults with drug policy experts and other researchers, and chronicles die-in protests, and describes seemingly endless courtroom hearings. Another thread Macy follows is the long-running bankruptcy litigation of one of the primary distributors of prescription opioid painkillers, Purdue Pharmaceutical, and the company's founding Sackler family, who are confronted by survivors of the addiction epidemic as they strive for justice. But the heart of the book is the harm reduction warriors, like Mathis, and nurse practitioner Tim Nolan, who move from trap houses, where drugs are made, used, and sold, to encampments, under bridges and jail cells to provide addicts with protection against overdosing and disease, while providing low-barrier options for treatment. And as with Dope Sick, Macy's new book prominently features men and women moved by their faith to work alongside those wrestling with addiction. Olive Branch, which also does peer support and community education, doesn't evangelize or try to convert people, Mathis told Religion News Service. "We believe someone is where we were. Religious people have often told addicts that they were sinners and failures," she said, "but Jesus loves them." Her job, Mathis said, is to tell them, "If you're having a great day, I'm going to celebrate with you. If you ever have a bad day, I'm going to mourn that day, but I'm going to be there." In 2019, when Macy was writing the book, United Methodist pastor Ray Morgan was working in a church in Mount Airy, North Carolina, where, along with other clergy, he was educating the public and trying to be supportive of those who were doing the work of harm reduction. Morgan and his colleagues had been told by their flocks that the opioid epidemic was the most important thing that they could tackle. He recalled one conversation he had with Mark Willis, director of the Surrey County Substance Abuse Recovery Team. Morgan asked Willis, "What do you need from the church?" He said that Willis's answer was hope. "What does the church have if we don't have hope?" "We have the hope of the world," added Morgan. "To me, it was a no-brainer." Morgan, who had gotten to know people grappling with addiction as the layperson at Green Street United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem, became an outspoken advocate for harm reduction. "It's one of the easiest and best ways to get somebody to go into recovery because," he said, "there's at least one person who's coming to them who cares enough to show up." In Mount Airy, Morgan and his group of pastors got busy handing out survivor bags, which included items like fresh underwear, toiletries, hats and gloves, the Gospel of John, and a list of county resources. They also informed local law enforcement about what they were doing. While Morgan praised the efforts to reach addicts around Mount Airy, he said that Christians in general have a lot of work to do to quell the stigma around addiction. Quit calling them addicts. They are not addicts. They are people made in the image of God, children of the Most High. And we are commanded by Jesus to love them. In an interview, Macy put it more bluntly, if churches aren't relevant, why should they exist? They would be more vibrant, and they would feel better about themselves if they reached out to the people in their communities. Brett McCarty, a theological ethicist at Duke University, has spent more than 5 years researching the role houses of worship play in addressing the opioid crisis and broader substance abuse in southern Appalachia. McCarty cautions those congregations who think any single approach, whether it be harm reduction or a 12-step program to address substance abuse, can easily translate into churches who have different cultures and diverse theological perspectives. They have found, he said, that one-size-fits-all approaches do not work. If you try to make one thing everybody could buy into, nobody would like it very much. We've got to meet churches where they are, because that's harm reduction too. That approach has a lot more hope than an outsider coming and saying, if you don't have a syringe exchange, you clearly hate people like that. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.